Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with tech and Torah guru, Hillel Fold. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. Hillel Fold is a world-renowned strategic advisor who left his extraordinarily successful career behind on 10/7 in order to follow a calling and devote himself full-time to Israel advocacy and fighting anti-Semitism. The brother of Israeli folk hero Ari Fold, Hillel is blazing his own path in his brother's legendary footsteps to defend Israel on the Eighth Front, the War of Words. Hillel has been a relentless warrior in not only dispelling the anti-Israel myths and propaganda online, but also in teaching faith and morality through the lens of Torah. With over half a billion social media impressions since the October 7th massacre, Fold is making a tremendous impact in Israel, in the world Jewish community, and far beyond. Today, Hillel and I will discuss modern-day reality because facts matter, and modern-day miracles because they happen to be everywhere. Dubbed Israel's top marketer, journalist, and social influencer, Hillel Fold works with leading tech entrepreneurs, investors, and visionaries to accompany them on their journey from idea to revenue. Since the war began on October 7th, Hillel has been dedicated to utilizing his skills, team connections, and abilities to promote the positive message of Israel and the Jewish people and to combat anti-Semitism through social engagement. Hillel, thank you so much for joining me. It is such a tremendous honor.
Thank you for having me, first of all. Second of all, I'm a little bit speechless from that introduction. I feel like I should send you a PR check or something for that. That was like the nicest introduction ever. Thank you so much for the kind words. I appreciate it. And no one's ever called me a Torah guru before, just so you know.
Oh, okay. Well, there's always a first of all. And second of all, feel free to send the PR check. You're not the only one who gave up your career for this. Okay. I mean, I'm only half joking about that, by the way. Okay. Getting into it. Hello. So I feel like the Jewish nation, and I'm going to use the Jewish nation broadly, not just to represent Israel, but really the world Jewish community, that we're in a moment much like World War II, when every man, woman, and child in the USA contributed to the war effort. It seems like a bygone era in America when people want to ask what they could do for their country, but in Israel, it's built right into the DNA. When Israel called up the reservists in the wake of 10/7, 120% reported. I mean, 120%, many who weren't even called up, and many of them literally had to be turned away. There's no one in Israel that hasn't been directly affected by this war, and everyone is doing his or her part. Your part was literally putting your international business ventures aside in order to advocate full-time for Israel. Well, I have to know, was this a sacrifice or was it just a calling?
An interesting question. For starters, I can say that I had a level of moral clarity on that day that really I would bless all my friends that they should one day achieve that level of clarity. It was clear to me what I needed to do. I didn't have any doubts about that I needed to shut down the business and repurpose, my audience and my network to help Israel, right? That was clear to me. That being said, I'd be lying if I'd say it wasn't a sacrifice. I mean, I really did shut down a multi-million dollar consulting business that I'd built over the last decade and a half. And literally, shut down sources of income. Again, not to say that I regret that or even think for a second that that's not what I should have done. But I'm not going to pretend that it's not been a challenge. It definitely comes with challenges, no question about it.
Sure. These are such hard decisions to make sometimes, but again, there's that balance between decision and just moral imperative. And I've really been focusing on this podcast on the people who feel the moral imperative because of this conundrum of nothing is imperative about or morality. It's something that we create and that we decide ultimately. So on that note, I'd love to talk about your brother as briefly or extensively as you wish. For those who don't know, Hillel's brother, Ari, was murdered by a Palestinian terrorist in 2018 and lives eternally as a larger-than-life legend in Israel. I think about his very last video, in which he was not only, ironically, interrupted by news of a terrorist attack, but also stopped himself on air, mid-discussion, to give a blessing to his daughter as she left the house. Do you see your commitment to your advocacy to some extent as an homage to your brother's legacy?
Well, for starters, just give kind of a little more context to your viewers and listeners. Ari, I'm one of five boys, right? We're five boys, and Ari was the one that's directly above me. And so, you know, we grew up in the same house. We grew up, pretty close in age. And, when we started our careers, we kind of worked in parallel tracks because we both were promoting Israel, but he was promoting Israel in a lot more a difficult, I would say, challenging setting. Meaning he was directly advocating for Israel. I was advocating for Israel through tech, right? And everyone loves tech. So it was, my job was a lot easier than his. But, you know, there were kind of crossovers and overlaps, specifically when, you know, let's say he'd be mass reported on social media and I would have to kind of pull my strings at Meta or Instagram to get him reinstated. But he was a very, very strong Israel advocate. And when you say his last video, again, if somebody's watching, they don't know what that means. He would do pretty regularly. He would record live streams on Facebook and other platforms, often centered around Torah, Israel, the Jewish people, and kind of the intersection of those three. He was a very outspoken Israel advocate, definitely had a lot of people who disagreed with him because, you know, I would never say he was an extremist, but he had strong opinions. So that was his last video. And on the eve of Yom Kippur 6 years ago, he was walking in his town. It is a town outside of Jerusalem, about 15 minutes outside of Jerusalem, called Efrat. And he was shopping for his family. And you know, a kid, right? Really, let's just say it as it is. He was a 16-year-old kid, came from behind and stabbed him in the neck in a main artery, at which point Ari was basically medically dead, right? He basically did not have blood in his veins. But somehow, miraculously, he was able to chase down the terrorist, jump over a wall, get down in shooting position, and shoot the terrorist when he was just inches away from his next victim. Ari didn't kill the terrorist, but he basically saved that woman who the terrorist was going after. Her name is Hila, and she had a falafel stand there, and she had just served the terrorist lunch, not knowing, obviously, that he's a terrorist. She has since become part of the family. After Ari shot the terrorist and saved her, he obviously collapsed and died. He has since become a official national hero of the state of Israel, being that in his last breath, he saved someone's life. But really, like you said, he lived larger than life. He died larger than life. He lived a hero. He died a hero. And I, you know, as far as my work, I ask myself, WWAD, what would Ari do on a regular basis, right? You know, how would Ari respond to this person? Because, for example, right, I get, as I'm sure you do, a ton of hatred on the internet, a ton of poisonous. And so the question is always, do I engage, do I not engage? And Ari's opinion on this was always engage, because even if that person's not listening to you, there are other people watching this dialogue who need to know the truth. I would say that Ari was a lot stronger than me in that sense because I can't engage with everyone. But often I do kind of have my finger on the block button and then I say, wait a second, what would Ari do? And I do engage. So, you know, yes, a lot of what I do is following in his footsteps. A lot of what I do is inspired by his work. A lot of what I do is, I would say, is guided by his work. We realize in his lifetime, and I realize now that, you know, if we don't stand up for ourselves, no one will.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there. First of all, I always have this play on words. It's funny, when growing up in America, when my parents taught us Shema, and it was always first you say it in Hebrew and then you say it in English, right? And as we know, as children, sometimes words come out differently because of what you hear versus what they are. And so in my world, it's always been built in the DNA, the hero Israel. That is not just Ari, but it is a nation full of heroes. And I want to get into that. Two more things before I move on. This concept of the number of children being killed in Gaza. Can you just specify how old was this terrorist who murdered your brother?
He was 16. He was 16. And, you know, listen, I don't know how deep you want to get into this topic, but, you know, since you brought it up, I just have to address one thing. And that is that if one were to take a step back and look at this war with a little bit of a wider historic lens, objectively, I know it's not easy to do, but if one were able to remove bias and just look at this war objectively, they would realize that there are so many things about this war that are just illogical. And the list is long, right? But just because you mentioned it, the fact that there are otherwise intelligent and moral people who are going around quoting casualty numbers that were provided to them by a terrorist organization is just mind-boggling. Like, how does an otherwise intelligent person think it's logical or moral to go around saying Israel is doing this because Hamas told me that Israel killed this many people? It's ridiculous. And, you know, you could say what you want about Israel, but when Israel makes a mistake, Israel owns up to it. And so we, you know, people die in war and it's very sad, but Israel has released the preliminary numbers and they're not even close. And by the way, not only not even close, but the UN itself modified right. Their numbers. So, like, you know, it's time we start paying attention to truth. And, you know, that should be so trivial and so obvious. Like, of course, truth is truth. But the reality is that truth has no longer, it's no longer a virtue. People don't care about truth anymore. And if Ari left any legacy, it's let's not ignore words. Words matter. Let's call it what it is and use words responsibly because words do matter. And so, you know, I mean, this kid, he was a kid, but it's not about Ari's murderer. I mean, you could look at any poll that you want. You could take the most pro-Palestinian poll. Hamas has, and I'm sorry for this comparison, and I hope I don't offend anyone, but Hamas has significantly more support in Gaza than Hitler ever had in Germany. And no one questions whether World War II is justified. Yes, millions of innocent Germans died in World War II. It's tragic. That's war. We didn't want this war. Israel didn't start this war. Israel never started any war, right? So this war was brought upon us. Innocent people die. We're doing more than any army has ever done to minimize civilian death, while our enemy is doing more than anybody has ever done to maximize civilian death. We're dealing with conditions that no one has ever dealt with. And despite that, we're still seeing a ratio that is unparalleled and unprecedented in terms of the low number of civilian casualties in Gaza and, of course, in Lebanon. So let's be accurate here. Yes, my brother's murderer was a kid, but unfortunately, the society in Gaza and beyond, it really is sadly, tragically rotten to the core. And these children are taught and indoctrinated from age zero that their ultimate accomplishment in life is to murder a Jew. Let's just say it as it is. That is the reality in Gaza.
Sure. And I have had conversations on this show, both with John Spencer and Andrew Fox, who get very deeply into all of this. There is no question for anybody, Richard Kemp, who's been in this game longer than both of those men combined. If you look at the facts, you understand, but we definitely live in a post-factual society. The reason I'm pointing out that he's a child is because in these wonderful Hamas numbers, let's keep in mind that even if we took it at face value, it actually is the Ministry of Health numbers of everyone who has died in Gaza, including old age, including car accidents, including cancer, including all the things, including the 25% to 30% of Hamas missiles that misfire and kill their own people. The numbers are staggeringly and grossly overstated. But when they say mostly women and children, people have to understand that being 14 or 16 or 17 year old terrorist also qualifies you as a child in these numbers. It's right. So, it's grotesque.
Morally bankrupt. It's morally bankrupt. That's what it is.
It is. And before I go on, I also just want to make a note on like blocking, because in the beginning, because I've been in this game for a long time, you've been in this game for a long time, and my list of people who are blocked on every platform, I mean, it would probably take days to get through, because for years I was just like block, 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 sometimes report, 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 right? But the reports usually go nowhere. These days, I'm a little bit more discerning. If somebody wants to argue a point with their perceived facts, even if they're grossly disrespectful, I will engage with them. But if their only comment is, you know, something horrible that should happen to me, my nation, or my people, then those are the people I block. Do you have like a criteria for who you block and who you engage with and who you just let languish?
So first of all, I mean, some of the things that are sent to me, whether it's a response to a tweet or an email, are hard to describe in words, because you could not do anything to me. I don't care what you do to me. You could not do anything to me that would enable me to write the words that these people write to me. You have to understand, like many people, and this is a real thing, found pictures from my brother's funeral, which I swear I had never seen before. I don't even know how they found these pictures. Pictures of my brother's crying, and they took it and they photoshopped it and they showed blood streaming down my brother's and Ari's kids. And they sent me that tweet with a smiley face and ha ha ha. Like, you got to be a really sick, sick individual to do something like that. And that's just one example of thousands. So, you know, there are some people obviously who go past the line of engagement, but I have to say something that I don't think I've ever said publicly, and I'm being totally genuine when I say this actually breaks my heart. Like, this is, to me, this is one of the tragedies of this war, and that is that in the beginning, when I would get a new follower or a comment, and it was, you know, someone with an Arabic name or a Muslim name, and even if it was someone with Arabic in their profile, I would be like, okay, great. So this, you know, he's Muslim, I'm Jewish, let's have a conversation. But it got to a point that 99.9999% of the people that have Arabic in their names or do have Muslim names and are commenting or engaging or unfollowing, 99.9% of them are going to end up attacking me. So it's gotten to the point, and I say this really with a broken heart, that when I see someone who follows me and they have Arabic or a Muslim name, I just block them automatically, because I know what's about to happen. And it's again, I want to say very clearly that, call me racist, fine. But I'm telling you that for months, for years, I didn't do this. But it got to a point that every single time someone would follow me and they'd have a Muslim name or Arabic in their profile, within 5 to 10 minutes, they would be attacking me and my family with words that honestly, that polluted my soul. Like, you know, say like, okay, fine, big deal. Let them say whatever they want. No, like, you know what? We're human beings. We have souls. There's certain things that we are not meant to see, to read, to hear. And it got to the point that these people, so many of them, a vast 99% of them, would say these things to me that, unfortunately, I'm sure that I have in this war blocked people that actually were innocent. And that breaks my heart.
Wow. You state that so clearly. It's my internal struggle, because you sort of want to believe that the messages, I don't know why, that come to a woman would be different than the violent, horrific ones that come to a man. I don't know why, but they're not. Believe me, they're not.
Oh, I believe you.
And sometimes I'm like, Shauna, they're words. Like, I, along with Hero Israel, I also learned sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Like, why is this so devastating? And you stated it really clearly. Like, a soul is not supposed to encounter this kind of even verbal abuse. And you're right. Like, if you look at anything having to do with Israel on social media right now, and you look at the comments, like, the pro-Israel comments will be stuff like, bring our hostages home, you know, Am Yisrael Chai, like very positive, Israel, you know, and U.S. must stand together, whatever it is, it's all very positive messaging. And then you literally, and granted, a lot of it is bots, but somebody programmed the bots.
Exactly. They're
the most vile, violent, horrific, inhuman, bestial comments. That it does. It crushes It crushes the soul.
Yeah, I was thinking about this literally an hour ago because, you know, once a day I'll go into my Facebook and just review today's post and go into the comments. And without exception, there are, you know, those horrible comments. And I look at them and I'm like, you know, pictures of Jews with big noses, picture of, you know, with BB with dog, you know, excrement on him. Like, how old are you? Like, what is, why can't we have a debate? Like, you get this, is, you know, Israel and, you know, long, just like, let's, you want to have a discussion. Let's have a discussion. Why do you have to go there? Like, why the name calling? Why the profanity? Like, you will very rarely, every rule has exceptions. And there are extremists on our side too. Don't misunderstand me. You will very rarely see someone pro-Israel or Jewish who comments that kind of stuff on social media. I've never seen it. Almost without exception. So, like, why? I mean, why is there that contrast? You know, you have to ask yourself that question. Why is there such a sharp contrast between our narrative, our language, and their language? Why is there such a sharp contrast? I don't know the answer to that question.
But even more disturbingly, why is that the narrative that the so-called social justice warriors are clinging to? And I know the answer. We could say it in unison. If I say 1, 2, 3, the answer is Jews. That's not like a surprise, but we live in this hypersensitive, ultra-tolerant, microaggressive, like everything is offensive society where in this one thing, anti-Semitism, just goes completely off the charts. All other hate, and when I say hate, I mean, I just got an article, I'm sure you saw it too, about somebody being, I think, expelled from Harvard or something for violent pointing, or arrested for violent pointing. And I'm like, but it's okay for you to call for the death and destruction of all Jews in the Jewish nation. That's okay. In fact, it's celebrated.
Right.
Like,
it's crazy.
How did we go so wrong?
You know, I agree with every word that you're saying, but I'll just add one thing. All of that horror is amplified in a major way by social media. You do realize that, right? Because in social media, there's no nuance, right? You can't say, you know, I don't know if you want to go there or not, but like, forget, I'm not even going to, you can't say in politics, for example, it doesn't make American politics relevant. You can't say, you know, this candidate, you know, is a bad person. I don't like them, but they have amazing policies. You can't say that. It's either villain or hero, but that's not real life. It's not. Real life is gray. And so I got to tell you an experience that I had today. True story. You know, one of the hot topics in Israel right now is the draft of the ultra-Orthodox, whether they should go to the army or not. Right. And I've been pretty vocal about it. And consistently, there's this one guy who in the comments, you know, we debate and it gets heated. And I know this guy for 30 years, and you know, it got to the point of name calling, like whatever. And so I reached out to him and I said to him, listen, maybe we should actually sit down, have a cup of coffee, let's discuss this. And today we did that. We sat offline in a cafe and had this discussion. And shock to no one, 95% of the issue we agree upon, 5% we disagree. But on the internet, you would think it'd be the other way around because the internet amplifies the lack of nuance. And it's sad, but that's the reality of the internet.
Sure. The other reality is that in time and time again, poll after poll, it shows that the Western world, about 80%, stands with Israel. You would not know that by the social media. But I want to get into social media because it's such an important topic. But before that, I do want to go back to really your family legacy, because again, I've been focusing on a lot of people who don't have skin in the game in order to really get an objective perspective on what's going on. But there are a few people probably who have more skin in the game than you do, not just as an Israeli, not just for giving up your career, not just for your brother, but your son is also serving in the IDF. I want to talk briefly because there's this world misconception that all Israel is this bloodthirsty murderers and all we want is death, destruction, and to take over the world. Can you tell me a bit or tell the audience about the very complex feelings that go through your mind, your heart, and even your soul as your son is entering into Gaza?
Sure. So before I answer that question specifically, I just want to point out another inconsistency, another paradox in their narrative, which is Israel is so strong and it's uneven, right? They're this genocidal, crazy, strong with F-16s and poor Palestinians. So if we're so strong and we are able to flatten Gaza, why are we sending in foot soldiers? If we're looking to commit genocide and we want to just kill, then why aren't we not bombing from the air and just flattening it to make it into like a football field? Why are we sending in our soldiers? Why is my son going into Gaza? Why? If we wanted to commit genocide, we want to kill them all, we wouldn't send in soldiers. So just another inconsistency in the long list of their inconsistencies. But the truth is, you know, my son, my oldest son, Zvi, is finishing his basic training in 2 days from now and then going into Gaza. And it really is a mixed bag of emotions that I don't know that anyone anywhere else can experience. Because on the one hand, deep, deep, deep pride. Like if I told my grandmother in Auschwitz, your grandson is going to serve in the Israel Defense Forces and defend his people and his country, she wouldn't even know how to digest that information. That would sound like a fantasy to her, right? And so deep, deep pride that my son has the historic opportunity and privilege to fight in the Israeli army, an army that we could have only dreamt of for thousands of years. So what deep pride we all feel. On the other hand, you know, how do you sleep at night? And by the way, he's my oldest son, my second son, who's now 18, just got his draft, right? So I'm going to have two sons in. And, you know, I'm not going to beat around the bush. It's terrifying. There's no sugarcoating it. I'm probably not going to sleep for many, many nights. You know, I guess I have to tell myself as an observant Jew that, you know, I do believe that Hashem, that God has a plan here. I don't know his plan, of course. I don't know why he does what he does or why he allows certain things to happen. I don't know. But I do believe that if I look at our situation today, look at this war from an objective perspective, which is not easy to do because we're so deep in it. But if I take a step back and I widen my lens and look at this from a historical perspective, it's pretty clear what's going to happen here because history repeats itself and we know what happens. What happens is that in every generation, without exception, they come after the Jews prevail, they end up winning whatever that situation, whether it's a war, whether it's something else, whether it's the annihilation of the Jews in the times of Purim or whatever it may be, or 210 years of backbreaking slavery in Egypt, right? And then that empire that comes after us is brought to its knees and eventually disappears into the history books while we continue to thrive, continue to flourish. And we all know that phrase, Am Yisrael Chai, but I don't think many people, at least I can speak for myself, I didn't think much of it. I didn't really sit and think what that means. And it's not just a catchphrase. It's not just a nice song. Am Yisrael Chai is a historical reality. And if you don't believe me, then go try to figure out how many Babylonian friends you have, right? Right? They're all gone. Where are they? Where are these empires? Where's the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, the ancient Egyptian Empire, the Nazi Empire, the Soviet Empire? I could keep going. They're all gone. And here we are. So I know how this ends and it ends well for us. Okay. That being said, unfortunately, there's a lot of suffering that we're experiencing. We will surely experience until we get to that ultimate victory. So on a personal level, yes, it's scary. You know, it's even sad. My baby, right? But on the other hand, I'm deeply, deeply proud of him. And I know that, you know, he feels that pride as well.
Yeah. One of the questions that people ask me all the time, just because I'm so involved with Israel and spend so much time there, is like, how can a parent stay in Israel knowing that their child is, there's a very good chance that when you have a child, that child will go to war. And I'm like, you don't, like, just like people cannot understand the mindset of a terrorist, because it's literally not even in our radar, right? Just like I can't, like, there's nothing that would ever drive me to forget about, like, the things that happened in 10/7, like you said, to even just write one of those comments that are just so cruel. When you don't have the proper frame of reference, it's impossible to really fully understand the mindset that the Israelis have always lived under this right. threat, right? From the moment of its existence, it was attacked 5 hours later from every border. So as a complacent American, there's no American Jew. It's very
unrelatable.
expected to not understand why somebody, first of all, people who live in Israel for a reason. Some people, yes, you just live there, but you could always leave. And the people who are in Israel are the protectors of our nation. And again, when I say nation, I'm talking about the Jewish nation, not just the state of Israel. And it's impossible for us as Americans to understand that, yes, they do know that when they have a child, there is a chance that they will be called to defend their nation. And let me just be clear, this is not the same as children being brought up to be martyrs, to be willing to blow themselves up for a nation. It's a very, very different thing. A child in Israel is born to protect a legacy, and a child born in Gaza is born to destroy a legacy.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm obviously going to push back on the comparison. I know you weren't making a comparison, but I still have to say it so that it's not taken out of context. Sure. I understand where you were going with that. You were saying that we can't understand the mindset of a terrorist. You can't understand the mindset of Israel. I get it. Obviously, let's try to stay away from those comparisons. But I understand what you were saying. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think, for starters, I just want to say that you said that, you know, someone who goes to the army here is the defender of the Jewish people, of our nation. I actually think that's, I'm not going to say inaccurate, but that's not 100% the truth. The truth is that when you go to the Israeli army, you are not defending Israel or the Jewish people. You are defending Western civilization. And anybody who doesn't accept that is just ignoring reality. They say it. Radical Islam, no matter whatever fancy name you want to give it, ISIS, Hamas, Hezbollah, it's all the same garbage. They say what their goal is. Their goal isn't Israel. Their goal is Western civilization. Period. And if you don't accept that, then you're sticking your head in the sand. So when an Israeli 18-year-old goes to the army, he's not just defending Israel, not just defending his people, he's defending the world, the Western world, and everything that we believe and hold sacred. But yes, the truth is 100%. You cannot, if you're not in the mindset of, you know, of survival, right? You have to survive, then you can't understand what, you know, I'd rather go, like, you know, send my kid to whatever college and let him party, let her party, let him not, then go and hold an M16 and defend and be accountable for my friend's life. It's hard to grasp, but when you teach a kid that, you know, they want to glorify life, and that's the fundamental, they glorify death, we glorify life. Just fundamental difference, right? But when you teach someone from a young age that life is the ultimate ideal, living life and living a, you know, a life that makes the world a better place, then they're going to do everything they can to defend that value. And that is what Israel, and that's what Israeli kids do. They go to the army, not, it's called Israel Defense Forces. Israel's never started a war ever, right? We are here to defend and to glorify life. That's the story of the Jewish people.
Yeah. And so the defense of the values is, no matter how twisted it becomes in the UN, in the ICC, in the ICJ, people see these things and think they're such noble efforts. They have been hijacked by terrorists. So let's just put that aside. There is nothing noble about the case against Israel. But you have so effectively used your social media influence to make an honest impact on the global narrative about the state of Israel and the state of Judaism. You have, just in the last few minutes, you have dismantled lies. You take your time to educate the masses based on your Jewish values, your Israeli values, and your Western values. They are one and the same. And at least the people who are open to truth and facts, you are touching them. You are making a difference. Let's contrast that with what's going on in the mass media, which is so heavily stacked against Israel that if you want a pro-Israel narrative in America, you basically have Fox and no other options, except for, I mean, obviously fringe stuff, but when it comes to mass media, it's so stacked. So I want to ask you first, what do you think is more important in this war of words and values? Is it the mass media or is it social media?
Well, we have to dissect that for 1 second, because we have to understand the mechanism called media, right? I mean, the very mechanism of media is broken, fundamentally broken. Why? Because how are journalists measured? How is media measured? By traffic. How much traffic does that website get? Meaning clicks, eyeballs, right? Now, we know what gets eyeballs. Sensationalism, right? Lies, right? Poison. No one's going to get a lot of views by saying, oh, the Jewish state is acting so morally. Like, that's not a story, right? That's not exciting. That's not sexy, right? And so by definition, it is built by design to encourage lies, right? And so mass media, and by the way, that applies to social media as well. The algorithms are no different, right? And so, you know, that's one of many reasons that I, both in my business and in my Israel advocacy, I would never take money for traffic. I would never monetize my audience and say, I'm posting this and you're paying me to, because then I lose, you know, credibility, right? Then I'm posting something to get more clicks. And again, truth doesn't get more clicks. And so, you know, in this war of narratives, of words, of truth, I would say media, not for sure mainstream media, legacy media, but in many instances, social media as well, are just fundamentally broken. We see so many otherwise intelligent people. You know, I'm going to give an example because this isn't, you know, something he's ashamed of. He's proud of this, right? You know, in the tech world, there's a person, a man who is a legend in the tech world, right? There's a guy named Paul Graham, started the world's biggest accelerator for startups, the accelerator from which Airbnb was born and many other leading companies. He's one of the top investors in the world, and that's just an objective fact. He's a brilliant tech investor. And he is a blatant anti-Semite. He doesn't even pretend the whole, oh, I'm just anti-Zionist. He's just an anti-Semite. Now, how does that happen? Like, I think about this all the time. This guy's a brilliant dude. How is he so blind? So, you know, I think you look at a guy like that and you see that his stuff, which is just pure poison, gets such wide exposure because that's what sells on social media. And so, you know, unless a person cares about truth, unless a person, you know, has a moral compass, both mechanisms, both traditional, you know, legacy media and social media are fundamentally broken. If you know how to use them effectively and not abuse them, they could both become tremendous megaphones that can reach, you know, audiences and numbers that the world has never known. People have to understand this. Like, you know, we're talking about, just to give an example, Facebook, we're talking about 2.5 billion daily users. 2.5 billion people. Like, that's a number the world has never known. And so if you know how to use these platforms effectively, you know, and you said in the intro that I've reached 500 million impressions. Sorry to flex and correct you, but I've reached close to 2 billion impressions in this war. And I'm a one-man show. It's just with my thumbs, by the way. All organic. I never spent a dime promoting anything. I've never, ever. So, you know, I'm not going to say about myself that I'm a guru. I don't like that word. But I will say that, pardon me for not being too humble right now, but I will say that in the war, if there's any, you know, sugarcoating this situation or finding anything positive here, it's that I've pretty much cracked the algorithm. I pretty much know what to say it, how to write it. And it's, by the way, not what many people would think. Just to give you one example, many people say the shorter a post, the more exposure it's going to get because people have no attention spans. That's true if the content's not good. But if the content is good and has real substance there, you'll actually see the opposite. My longer posts get farther reach. So just to kind of sum up what I'm saying here, the answer is both legacy media and social media, unless used effectively in conjunction with a moral compass, both of them are fundamentally broken.
I'm sorry. I'm actually not crying. It looks like I'm crying.
You can cry.
I'm choking. Like I woke up this morning with like this thing in my throat and I'm like, please don't happen in the middle of the podcast. And here it goes. Anyway, it is interesting. But the truth is that so much of this rabid and most violent anti-Semitism is coming from the younger generations, which is our future generation of leaders. And many of these kids do not even look at legacy media. They don't even look at mass media. They are 100% TikTok, you know, plus a little bit of maybe Instagram in there. But listen, you're in tech. And when I say I hate to ask this, I mean, I really hate to ask this. And I'm going to say it for a third time, just to emphasize for our listeners. I hate to ask this because I truly believe in playing fair. But it's been so well documented that the anti-Israel propaganda machine has flooded social media with bots, which in turn skew the algorithms and simultaneously drown out the pro-Israel voice. Is there a kosher way to impact the narrative if we employed the same strategy?
Listen, it's a valid question that I've been asked 1,000 times. So, I understand why you're saying you hate to ask it, but it's a valid question. The answer is, in my opinion, unequivocally no. Because even if we, let's say, play their game and stoop to their level and, I don't need to tell you, I don't need to remind you that Israel is at the pinnacle of the world of technology. We could program these bots in 12 seconds, right? We could, quote unquote, by that, win this quote unquote war. But are we really winning? Is that really victory, right? I mean, again, we... At the most foundational level, we are sticking to the truth. And by the way, not only when the truth is convenient, when Israel makes mistakes, we stick to the truth as well, right? And that has happened, even in this war. So I don't think that if we stoop to their level and do that, that we will have accomplished anything long term. I think that would actually be us losing the war, because we need to stick to the truth. We need to, tell the story as it is, even if, and this is a really important point, even if by definition, our narrative, by definition, will never be as sexy as their narrative. It just won't, because their narrative, the fundamental, right, is you are oppressing us, free Palestine. That's it. If I'm 95 years old or I'm 3 years old, I can understand that narrative, right? It's just so simple, and it appeals to everyone, right? It appeals to, obviously, to the radical side. It also appeals to the social, warriors. Oh my gosh, they're the underdog. Let's fight for the Palestinians. When, again, the irony and the paradox here is that the Palestinians are throwing people, gay people, off roofs. Like they're not ashamed to say that homosexuality deserves death. They say it like straight up. They're proud of it. And then there's these, the LGBTQ for Palestine. Like what? Again, just another thing on that item, another item on that long list of things that make zero sense. Zero. Just to answer your question, though, I don't think that would be a good tactic. I think that would be an absolute loss for us. It wouldn't be a victory. Even if we were able to beat them at their own game, that to me would not be victory.
Okay. And going back to the concept of Israeli DNA, I mean, if we go way back, I mean, even as far back as Ben Gurion, I mean, he's like, we don't, as long as we know we're doing the right thing, we don't have to defend ourselves. But there's also the fact that in the information age, even if that is the Israeli DNA, we also happen to live in a world where PIL, is that what it's called? The whatever missile that accidentally hits their own hospital, in 1 second, the world assumes that it was Israel and there's riots. So
yeah, PIJ.
Yeah. I think that leaning on these just sort of like historical moral values, sometimes maybe there's space for evolution. I mean, there's been so much criticism really for decades now of the Israeli PR machine. I think personally in this war, like the game has been stepped up massively. We're seeing daily briefings. Prime Minister, by the IDF, by COGAT. I mean, they're getting the word out. But we have to understand that Israel can talk themselves blue in the face, and they do, but they can't control the heavily biased and anti-Israel elements of the mass media or make them print anything they don't want to. I heard the prime minister spokesman the other day saying, I'm going to say this for like the millionth time and no one is reporting. There are, something like 700 trucks of aid waiting on the Gaza side of the border that haven't been distributed. He's like, I'll just say it again. I say it every single day. That's not what makes it into the news. This has been an uphill battle over a steaming dunghill. The media loves an underdog. Hard stop. Is there way at all for Israel to turn this media narrative around besides saying, okay, well, why don't we turn off Iron Dome for a week, let all our people be killed again? Because there was that blip, there was that second, there was that moment on October 7th when the world said, what, Israel? Oh my goodness, this is horrible. And I say a second because a second later, the narrative turned.
Yeah, I mean, even before Israel, you know, fired up one, you know, one F-16, the war was, even before we fired one bullet, they were already criticized. It was ridiculous. It was as if it was coordinated, by the way. That's a whole different discussion. But, you know, just think about this. I mean, you tell me, what would you click on, right? You're scrolling your Twitter feed, your Facebook feed, and you see two posts, right? You see a post saying, look at all these trucks on the border of Gaza, Israel sending humanitarian aid. Or you see another post with a dead baby. Now the baby's a doll. It's a toy, but it's a baby with blood streaming. What are you clicking on, right? We're the odds are working against us. Our narrative will never be. It will never be as sexy as their narrative, just by definition, especially amplified by the fact that they just don't care about truth. I mean, there's literal like Twitter accounts that are dedicated to exposing their blatant lie. I mean, it's gotten comical. I mean, there's literally a guy who we call on social media that FAFO, F around, find out guy, who it's the same person who literally appears in endless, like tens of different settings. One day he's a medic, the next day he's a journalist, the next day he's a father. And it's the same guy. Like you don't have to be a rocket scientist. Look at the guy's face, but nobody cares. Nobody cares because that's just not an interesting story. And if I'm a journalist and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, I understand what they're. If I'm a journalist and I need my job, I need to pay, I need to support my family. I'm not going to get clicks if I put a picture of 700 trucks, Israeli trucks of foreign aid on the Gaza border. That is not going to get me clicks and I will be fired. But if I put a dead baby who just happens to be a doll, but let's put that aside because it's a dead baby, that's going to get me clicks and I'm going to get a raise at work. What do you expect them to do?
Well, I think that Pallywood, which is, I think it's a pretty big story if someone were willing to break it at the New York Times, or, you know, perhaps they have, but if they did, it got buried, no pun intended. But I do believe that there's a lot of story to be had there that's purposely not being said. There is a lot of investigative reporting that would be just as intriguing and just as engaging. But I mean, you know, people like Barry Weiss, you know, who left the New York Times, I mean, among others, this the last few months we had a report from the BBC and in, of course, the NPR. I mean, in just how endemic the anti-Semitism and the anti-Israel, that if you submit a story that supports Israel, it is summarily dismissed. It literally cannot be printed.
Yeah. Which is amazing. I mean, you know, I think you just said for the first, I think if I'm not mistaken, this entire interview, for the first time you used this, you said the word anti-Semitism. And I'm going to say that, you know, people don't like when we pull, you know, play the anti-Semitism card. But again, I'll say it a million times, like the list of things here, if you're going to take anti-Semitism out of the picture, then explain to me what it means when people chant in the streets of America and the UK and France and every other, globalize the Intifada. What does that mean? Someone explain to me what that means without using the word anti-Semitism, because I'll tell you what it means. Intifada means violent uprising, blowing up buses, killing as many Jews as you can. When you say globalize the Intifada, what you are saying is kill as many Jews as you can on a global scale. Anybody who denies what I just said is lying. It's dishonest. That's what it means, which again, the paradox of the same people saying ceasefire now and then globalize the Intifada. Like, do they realize those things are mutually exclusive? It's comical. And the list is literally endless. I mean, what was Gaza before October 7th? Was it an open air prison? Or was it paradise that was destroyed by the Israeli genocide? Which one was it? Because before it was an open air prison, right? Poor Palestinians in open air prison. Open air prison? There was not, we left Gaza 20 years ago. There wasn't a single, talk about ethnic cleansing. We ethnically cleansed Gaza from Jews. There wasn't a single Jew in Gaza. What open air prison? But you know what? If you want to call it an open air prison, call it an open air prison. But don't change your narrative after they commit the darkest day in the history of the Jewish people since the Holocaust and Israel retaliates. All of a sudden, that place that you called an open air prison yesterday has become paradise.
What is with the hypocrisy? It's staggering that otherwise intelligent people believe these lies. It's wild.
Well, another amazing hypocrisy in the use of the word anti-Semitism, and that I was thinking about this yesterday, and like how, you know, we're not allowed to you know, mention the Holocaust because we're playing the victim card, like the most horrific mass murder in history, or at least in modern history, if not all of history, and we're not allowed to invoke that. But the irony of what you said, if we say anti-Semitism, then we are weaponizing a word against the word people who are saying it. And yet the very word Islamophobia was created to shut down discussion, that they use it in exactly the same way that they accuse us of using it, even though we're legitimately using it. So if you say, oh, 80% of Gazans in every poll that have come out support Hamas, all they have to say is that is Islamophobia. And they say that specifically to shut down the conversation. And if we say, oh, Hamas is anti-Semitic, they're like, wah, 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 you know, put on your diaper.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we really want to get into that topic, and again, you tell me if you don't want to go there, but forget Gaza and Hamas for 1 second. By all data that we have at our disposal, anywhere between 50 to 25% of global Muslims are fundamentalists. Now, 50 to 25%, that means 75 to 85% of them are peaceful people. Fantastic, right? Except one thing. We're talking about 300 million people dedicated to the destruction of the West. Meaning, even if you want to go conservative, we're talking about 180 million people. You can't just say, oh, you know, people have an illogical fear of Muslims. There are 300 million people who are dedicated to mine and your destruction in the name of Islam. To fear that is not irrational fear. It's very real. And as far as, you know, the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic thing, again, not many people will say this because they'll get penalized or punished or fired or whatever for saying it. But luckily, I don't have anyone that can fire me and I can say whatever the hell I want. To say the sentence, I am not anti-Semitic, I'm only anti-Zionist, is about the stupidest thing that a person can let out of their mouth. 95% of Jews are Zionists. If you are anti-Zionist, you are anti-Jewish, let alone the fact that Zionism, by its definition, is the movement to bring Jews back to their homeland after the world's worst genocide in history. If you're against that in a world where there are, you know, tens of Muslim countries and tens of Christian countries, you do not believe the Jews deserve one country after everything we've experienced, don't tell me you're not anti-Jewish. You are anti-Jewish. There's no, I'm anti-Zionism, I'm anti-Israel, but not anti-Jewish. If you're anti-Israel, you're anti-Jewish. There's no sugarcoating that. That is a fact. Anybody who says otherwise is being dishonest.
100%. Hillel, do you have more time? Because we're closing on an hour and I really want to get into Torah.
Let's do it. I'm good.
Okay, good. Because this is really the juicy stuff that interests me so much, because I think that so many people, and I think that even, I mean, I know I went through the phase, and I think that most people went through the phase where it's like, oh, Torah is just parable, like it doesn't mean anything, blah, blah, blah. This is ancient, blah, blah, blah. But it is such a living document, and every time you read it, something new comes off the page. And there's the fact that if you go to Israel, you can actually like see the places where the things happened. I mean, there's right. That. So I'm very fascinated lately with this concept of living Torah. And so this week, this Shabbat, the Parsha, the Torah portion, for those who don't know, we read a different portion of the Torah each week. And this week it was Noah, otherwise known as Noah in the flood. I bring this up because when we think of the story of Noah, we generally actually think about the happy salvation of this glorious ark filled with like animals, and there's rainbows, and there's people, and we don't really focus. Like I think there's so few people who approach this story in anything other than a purely intellectual
happy ending
that focus on the utter devastation of the flood. I mean, Perhaps no irony that Hamas, in fact, called 10/7 the Al-Aqsa flood. Historically, and even all the way back to biblical times, as you've mentioned, Israel and the Jewish people have always risen high above these floods, above these atrocities that have befallen us. So what other parables and prophecies, I know the list is too long to get into, so let's just get into your favorites, are we seeing playing out before our very eyes today?
Sure. So first of all, the list is very long. It's funny you should mention it, because I'm actually literally working on such a post with someone where I'm putting together all of the prophecies that are mentioned in the Talmud that are happening right before our eyes. But I don't want to even get into Talmud. Let's talk about literal, like, Old Testament Bible, black on white, not commentary, not Talmud, like literal words. Number one, you mentioned Noah, right? Noah was this past Shabbat's portion. And I mean, you could call this a nice coincidence. I clearly do not. I don't believe in coincidence. The Torah literally says, this is word for word, and your listeners and viewers are more than welcome to go verify this, when the Torah describes the chaos, the social chaos that you know, the world experienced before the flood, it uses a word to describe that chaos where there was murder and there was, you know, theft and crime, and it could have used many words. I mean, there are many words in the Hebrew language to describe that chaos, but the word that the Torah uses to describe that chaos is Hamas. Like, literally, that is the word in Noah, Hamas. That's first of all. I mean, if that doesn't blow your mind, then I don't know what will. But let's talk about next week's portion. Next week's portion is...
Quickly, Hilo, are there other instances of the word... I mean, I knew that, but are there other instances of the word Hamas being used in the Torah or in the Tanakh?
It's definitely in the Tanakh for sure. I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's another mention of the word Hamas in the actual Torah. I feel like there is, but I'm not sure that I can think. I feel like there is, but I don't know to quote it right now. But in the Tanakh, there definitely is multiple.
There's something unique about the story of Noah that was more chaotic and more depraved than other story. I mean, obviously, the destruction of the whole world probably.
I don't think, listen, again, it's hard for me to get, I can't analyze God and why he does what he does, but I can only imagine, as someone who believes that God is all good, I can't imagine that God would destroy the world unless there was something so extreme that he said, I have failed. These people have failed. I created these people and they have failed me. We need to start from the beginning. We need to have a fresh reboot. So, you know, it must have been that extreme and that evil. And to me, it's not a coincidence that that evil and that depth of just bad, right, is described as Hamas, because that is what Hamas is. They're just pure evil. That's what it is, right? And so, you know, I mean, they could have called themselves, Hamas could have called themselves whatever they want, but call it a coincidence. Maybe, I don't know. But to me, it signifies something. But I want to talk about next week's portion, because I got to tell you that in the beginning of the war, a friend of mine who's a very well-known and very popular rabbi in Boca Raton, Florida, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, came to speak in my synagogue in Israel, and he said something that literally blew my mind, because, and I'm going to tell you what it is in a second, this is a verse in next week's portion that, as a person who learned in Jewish school my entire life, I've read this verse a zillion times. I know it by heart, but I never paid attention to the words ever until he pointed this out to me.
And this is why I say it's a living document, by the way. You can
100%
find to keep
100%
information.
100%. So listen to this. This is so beautiful. He said like this. In next week's portion, God comes to Abraham and says, leave your home, leave where you live, leave everything you're familiar with, and go to the land of Canaan, which is Israel, right? And he says to Abraham four words that, again, to me were always trivial and I didn't think much of it. But now that they were pointed out to me, now I'm like, oh my gosh. He says the words in Hebrew. I'm going to translate. He says the words in Hebrew. Va'avarcha mevarechecha. Those who bless you, Abraham, will be blessed. Va'avarcha mevarechecha. Those who bless you will be blessed. Umikalelcha. Those who curse you. Now, you don't have to be a grammar geek to realize or to understand what the next word should be. Just from a purely grammatical, you know, a point of view, right? You have va'avarcha mevarechecha. The root of the word is bracha, blessing. Those who bless you will be blessed. It's the same root. And then it says, umikalelcha, those who curse you. The next word should be the same root. Akalel, I will curse. But that's not what the Torah says. It's fascinating. The Torah says, va'avarcha mevarechecha, those who bless you will be blessed. Umikalelcha, those who curse you, or It says "aor." "Aor" means "I will curse." But why does the Torah switch languages? Why isn't it parallel? Why doesn't it stick with the same root of the word? So Rabbi Goldberg said something fascinating. He said the word "aor," which again it means "I will curse," has another word in it, "or," light.
Light.
Exactly. Sure. And he says as follows. This is the right way to read that verse. This is so beautiful. Those who bless you, the Jewish people, those who stand in your corner in your darkest time, those who have your back right now will be blessed. Those who curse you will see your light. Those who bring darkness, they'll see your light. They'll see your delegations. They'll see your charity. They'll see your unity. They'll see the Nobel Prizes that Jewish people have won. They'll see who was first on scene when there's a natural disaster, the Jews. They'll see who leads the world in cancer research. They'll see your light. Those who bring darkness will only amplify your light. And that was like, oh my gosh, I read this verse a billion times. I never thought about it, but that's the reality of the Jewish people. Our enemies bring darkness and we bring light. And that's not in a supremacist kind of way. I'm not better than anyone else. It's a fact. You cannot deny that the Jewish people have brought tremendous light to our world. Not in a, you know, kumbaya voodoo, in a real way. Look at how many Nobel Prizes the Jews have won. It's disproportionate on a level that it defies logic. Really, it's miraculous. And so the Jewish people are a source of light in a very, very dark world. And we need to own that, just to kind of bring it back to our initial discussion about narratives. That should be our narrative. Unfortunately, we're so apologetic. We're like, oh, you know, Greek Empire, love us. We're just like you Romans. We're just like you Egyptians. We're going to stay back in Egypt, even though God just brought the 10 plagues and said, leave Egypt. 80% of them stayed back because, hey, I'm Egyptian. And today, who are the most liberal people in America? The Jews. We're going to be more American than you, but it doesn't work. You can't appease our enemies. And the more we think we could put out our light and be like everyone else, the more the world reminds us, using a tool that they've developed called anti-Semitism, who we are. They need to remind us in every generation. It's so tragic. I mean, you had Jews being led to the gas chambers who didn't even know they were Jewish. They're thinking to themselves, why are they? I'm a German. I'm enlightened. I'm just like them. But Hitler's like, no, you're not. No, you're not. You might not know that you're a source of light, but I know it. And I need to put out that light. And unfortunately, that's the lesson of history. But to just kind of bring back to your point that the Torah is a living document, you know, the most fundamental question is how? How did the Jewish people survive? How are they still here? Right? And the answer is in the Torah. Again, I'm not talking about commentary right now. I'm not talking about Talmud. I'm talking about the Torah, black on white, right? It literally says in the Torah, I'm going to say it in Hebrew, then I'll translate it. It literally says, when the Jews were in Egypt, the chasher ya'anu oto, the more the Egyptians persecuted the Jews, kein yirbeh v'chein yifrotz. The more they persecuted them, the more they multiplied, the more they flourished. Now that is a strange phenomenon. You would think that we're being persecuted, that we would, you know, go down, not go up. We wouldn't flourish, right? But that's our story. They terrorize, we innovate. That is our story. Our resilience, it surpasses all logic and all generations. It's the same story over and over and over again. And if you want to know what's about to happen, open the Torah, because it will tell you what's about to happen, because it keeps happening.
Yeah. I actually learned from Kabbalah how important it is to not just say the prayers, but to read the prayers, because of the importance, not just of the words, of the letters, of everything. And so even the prayers that I have memorized, which of course are most, and when I watch my rabbis who I love, you know, they never look at their book. They just, you know, like they're just saying the things. In paying attention, like so critically, particularly to Torah, to the weekly portion, it's been astounding to see how the last 14 months have unfolded in sync with the, because I sit next to a friend and I'm always like, look, yeah. I mean, look at this. Look what it says right here. And this is what's happening in Israel this week. And the fact that, again, like a rabbi has to give a drash on the same portion, the same week of every year. It's like, how many times can you talk about the same thing? And the answer is infinite. And in fact, you and I have another thing in common. I don't know if I've named a thing in common other than we're both Jewish and both proud Israeli, or I'm not an Israeli, proud of Israel. But you have said that you feel like a lot of the messages that come to you about Torah each week come from God, in there's no other way to explain it. And then I understand that there are people who are like, what, you think God is talking to you? And the answer is yes, God is talking to you and God is talking to all of us. So I'll tell you something that I did that was very similar was during the pandemic, I wound up reading, the evolution was random, but the Psalm 23 and the Mourner's Kaddish live on Facebook every single day for 365 days. And I gave a commentary every single day. Now, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a Torah guru. I'm not even a Torah scholar. I'm none of these things. And I did not look at anyone else's commentaries, not even once. I didn't look at what these prayers mean. I just meditated on them every day. And every day a message came to me what to say about these two passages. And I cannot explain it because I haven't, I mean, so I went to Jewish day school. Okay. So I was a kid and I've been to Torah studies, but I have not studied Torah in vain since I was in sixth grade. So there is no other explanation. God is always talking to us. The question is, are we listening?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'll tell you, you know, I say this pretty often, but it really, I cannot explain it any other way. I can tell you that for the past 7 years, seven cycles of the Torah, every Friday when I sign off for Shabbat, I post on social media that I'm signing off and I give a lesson from the Torah portion for leadership, meaning it's not a religious message. It's for leadership, for entrepreneurship. It appeals to a wider secular audience, which is what my audience is. Every single Friday for the past 7 years, where do these thoughts come from? I have no clue. I will sit on a Thursday afternoon next to my wife and I'll say, I don't know what to write this week. And she'll say to me, except that you've gotten it. Every single week for 7 years, you'll think of something. And guess what? I think of something. Okay. So I'll read, you know, Rabbi Sacks and I'll get inspiration, but these thoughts just land. I mean, I'll just give you one example, right? This, and you mentioned Noah, right? The story of Noah's Ark. The portion begins with Noah's Ark, right? But the portion ends with the Tower of Babel, right? Where the world speaks one language and they build this tower to try to reach God, right? And then the Torah says that what happens is God confuses the languages. So the obvious question is, it starts with the Noah's Ark and it ends with the Tower of Babel. Are those things connected? Is there any relevance there? Is there anything to learn there? You would think they're in the same Torah portion. There's got to be something to learn there. And the answer is, it screams at you. It's what happened in the time of Noah? In the time of Noah, it was chaos because everyone cared about themselves only, right? There was no authority. Everyone just, you know, chaos, right? There was crime because I cared about me. I don't care about the collective. It's only me, right? And that needed to be fixed. And then the Tower of Babel was the exact opposite. Everyone spoke the same language. There was no individualism. There was no individual rights. It was everyone's the same. And God says, that's not okay either. That is not how to build a society. In Judaism, only in Judaism, is there this balance between the collective, tradition, you know, government even, and individual rights. Those things in Judaism are not mutually exclusive. But in other philosophies and other religions, it's one or the other. What is radical Islam? You as an individual do not matter. Blow yourself up because this is the collective. This is our, you know, theology. This is what we believe. You don't matter, right? And then you have the other enemies of Israel on campus who don't care about tradition or heritage. They only care about themselves, their pronouns, their identity. Me, 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 me. iPhone, iPad, I. Everything's me in this generation. You have these two sides. They're both fighting Israel today. That is the portion of Noah. In Noah's time, it was me, 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 me. And in the time of the Tower of Babel, it was us and no me. It's that balance. That is what the Torah is. It's the balance. That's what Judaism brings to the world. To me, it was like so obvious. And it's like, how did I never think of that before? So I think God speaks to me every single week.
Sure. Here goes my coughing again. I'm so sorry.
You could at least pretend you're crying that I'm making you emotional, you know?
The reason that I don't have water, by the way, is because one time I actually spilled my entire like matcha that was like this big on my $5,000 MacBook Pro. And
oh,
I'm like,
no.
I will never bring liquid near, except for these tears that keep coming out, choking near my computer. Okay.
I hear that.
So let's talk about the miracles of Israel, because there's literally no other way to explain not just the forming of the state of Israel, but the existence to this day, literally November 4th, 2024. It has been nothing but one miracle after another that has brought us to this point.
Yeah.
This past 14 months, one might call that the silver lining to a very dark cloud, but it's the darkest clouds that are going to like shine the brightest on the edges. I think that most people, and probably almost all people, think of who aren't religious, and unfortunately, that is most people, think of miracles as little more than like ancient mythology. Can you highlight some of the modern day miracles that we've witnessed since 10/7?
Yeah. Oh, the list is literally endless. But I mean, let's just give you a few examples. So I had the incredible privilege and opportunity to sit with Dr. Danny Gold. Dr. Danny Gold is the man who invented the Iron Dome. Okay. And wow. I sat with him and I asked him, tell me how. Just like walk me through what transpired. Like, how did you? And he said to me, and this is not a religious man, he said to me, we were sitting in a room with the brightest minds in Israel, and there were rockets raining down in Israel, and we realized we had to do something. And everyone came up with their ideas, and he shot them all down. Pun very much intended. And he said, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. That I want to detonate rockets midair. And there was silence in the room. And they said, you want to what? He said, I want to detonate the rockets midair. And they said, you realize how fast a rocket's flying and how few seconds it is in the air. You can't detonate a rocket midair. And he said, that's what I want to do. They said, okay, but it's not possible. So he went to the Israeli army and he said, this is what I want to build. And they said, that's nice, not possible. He went to the Israeli government. They said, not possible. He went to the State Department, not possible. U.S. Army, not possible. And here we have a system that detonates rockets at 96% precision. You explain to me, you know what? I challenge you. I challenge your listeners and viewers to find me one military strategist in the world. Find me one who can explain to me how Israel, a country smaller than New Jersey, managed to detonate 98% of ballistic missiles and drones fired from Iran into this country. It does not exist. This is an open miracle. And when I say open miracle, I want to be very clear. I'm not talking about a hidden miracle. I'm talking about God splitting the sea before our eyes. I am talking about what we know in the desert as the Israelites went on their journey to the state, to the land of Israel. They had clouds of glory. They had clouds that protected them from all directions. That is the Iron Dome. It is the modern day clouds of glory. The Iron Dome is as open of a miracle as the splitting of the sea was. And I mean that literally. Okay. That's just one example, but it goes far beyond that because, you know, I was thinking about this today. Today alone, Hezbollah fired 100 rockets into Israel, and that's a daily occurrence. Now, I don't want to, God forbid, jinx it. Not that I believe in jinxes, but how many people, how many casualties has Israel had from those rockets? And to be clear, every single person that we lose, Jewish, not Jewish, doesn't matter. Every single innocent person that's lost is a tragedy in an entire world. And that is a statement that stands alone, and I'm not belittling or dismissing that. But if we take a step back, which is hard to do, and look at the amount of missiles and deadly rockets that were fired into this country, again, smaller than New Jersey, and the microscopic, statistically non-existent number of casualties from those rockets makes no sense. Because you know what? Even if we're talking about the Iron Dome detonating those rockets, what about the ones that aren't detonated by the Iron Dome? You know where they fall? In empty spaces. I mean, where are these empty spaces? Like, I live in Israel. I have no empty spaces here. Like, what is empty space? And we like, okay, we hear the news and we're like, oh, they landed in empty spaces. Sure, that makes sense. No, it doesn't. But you know what? I'm going to go even darker. And this is going to be controversial, but I strongly, to my core, believe what I'm about to say. We are in it right now, okay? We are all devastated. We are mourning. And it's very hard to see this objectively because we're in it. But if we force ourselves and we ask ourselves the following question, I think things will become clear. And I'm going to say it again. What I'm about to say is going to offend some people. I know that for a fact. Okay? You tell me, if I told you 100 years from now that there was a country smaller than New Jersey that 3,000 terrorists, genocidal maniacs, marched into with unlimited access to automatic weapons and 8 hours of free hand, how many people would you expect them to murder that day. Think about, just think about, they're spraying bullets in all directions with unlimited access to automatic weapons and just spraying bullets for 8 hours. I would have expected them to have killed 150,000 to 200,000 people. I would have expected Israel to have been wiped off the map. How did they, and I'm quote, air quotes, and I'm saying air quotes, how did they only kill 1,200 people? That makes no sense. Now, the word miracle is difficult to use to describe October 7th, right? Because miracle is something generally with a positive connotation, and October 7th was anything but positive. But if you take a step back and you realize what could have happened that day, you know, it's mind-boggling. It's hard to see because we're in it, but that day made no sense whatsoever. And you know, our ability to, you know, let alone the beepers, our ability to do what we've done militarily over the past 6 months, both in Gaza and in Hezbollah and in Lebanon. Again, find me a military strategist who can explain to me how that happened, or forget this war. Find me a military strategist who can explain how we won the 6 day war. It doesn't exist. None of this makes any sense. These are all miracles.
Well, keep in mind, coming back to the concept, in each life is a universe. The number of stories of people who survived Nova, who survived Beli, who survived Kfar Aza, who, you know, so the fact that Hezbollah did not jump in at that day with the same exact, I can't even imagine. So if you were to take the multiplier of each life being a universe, Rabbi Wolpe always says, you know, people always come in and ask me, you know, why did God give me cancer? Why did God make me lose my job? Why? He's like, but when do you, why don't you wake up and say, why did God give me all my limbs?
Yes.
Why did God give me a car? You know, why did God let me be born in Los Angeles, California, instead of, you know, Ethiopia or you know, somewhere where I work? It's so. I guess in it is uncomfortable what you, it's very uncomfortable what you're saying, but at the same time, the number of lives that were saved, again, like there's this force multiplier, because it's not just those lives that are saved, it's the families and the circles and the jobs and the things and how they're going to touch the world. And so, miracles are everywhere. They just happen to be even more in Israel.
Yeah.
Do you have any other miracles that you really want to point out?
You know, people, again, don't realize this, but that night, that second attack by Iran that we managed to, you know, I think there were no casualties as far as I'm aware, there were no casualties. People don't realize what went into that night, right? People are familiar with the Iron Dome. Some people are even familiar with David's sling. Many people aren't familiar with the arrow. What we have here is three aerial defense systems, each of which are sophisticated on a level that the world has never known, that all worked in perfect unison with 100% success. The chances of that happening, and again, this isn't me saying, I've spoken to people who led those operations. They were there on the ground. They said it. They built these tools. They said the chances of all of those working the way they work, impossible. Not unlikely, statistically impossible. That night was an open miracle. It was an open miracle. And our ability to, you know, what we did last week in Iran, people, oh, we didn't take out their nuclear facilities. Oh, what a failure. People don't know what we did that night. Do you understand that Iran is 100% vulnerable to Israel right now? They have zero aerial defense systems. We took them all out. Now, what's going to happen next? I don't know. There are many question marks. But what Israel was able to do that night, yeah, Israel has a strong army. Obviously, our fighter jets are amazing and world leading. Yes, even despite that, the success that we saw that night and again across the board throughout this war have no, as far as I can think of, have no logical explanations. To me, I'm seeing God in every single day, which again, of course, begs the question, well, if God's so involved, why did he let October 7th happen? And it's a good question. And it's a question that has been around for generations. And I don't have an answer to that question. I don't know. But I do want to strengthen what you said before. And that is, if someone's going to ask where God was in the Holocaust, then that person should at least be consistent and wake up in the morning saying, thank you, God, for letting me wake up in the morning. Be consistent.
Right. 100%. I'm going to take a pivot, and it's still Torah based, but I think, and I could be wrong, it's the opposite of a miracle. And it's this concept of the end of days. And I know I'm not alone in this, that Jews and Christians alike are watching what's going on in the world today and invoking this biblical prophecy. Now, this is just my pure ignorance. Like, the words end of days, to me, like, that's pretty self-explanatory. And yet I know it's not that simple. Can you tell us a bit about the end of days? And is it a bad thing?
So I wouldn't call it the end of days. I call it days of Mashiach, right? Yeah. And, you know, just disclaimer before I answer that question, I'm by no means an expert on this. I have studied the topic. I've watched, you know, quite a few documentaries on the topic, and it intrigues me. That being said, you know, there are people who are way, way, you know, bigger experts on this topic. But the little that I do know is that, you know, there are certain things that are described as we reach that point where Mashiach comes and basically, you know, I don't like the word salvation because it sounds very not Jewish, but, you know, when the world is saved.
For people who aren't Jewish, Mashiach means the Jewish Messiah.
Right. So, you know, one thing that many people have spoken about is that it says that right before Mashiach comes, the world will be upside down. Day will be night, night will be day, everything will be backwards. I mean, I don't even think I need to complete that sentence. I mean, it is so obviously happening today. Black is white, white is black, day is night, night is day. Terrorists are freedom fighters. It's crazy. It's just crazy, right? The world is just backwards. But also there is a quote unquote date. Or not a timeline, but a cutoff date, right? Where we know that after 6,000 years that, you know, according to the Jewish calendar, so we're a few hundred years away from that. So, you know, it has to happen by that date, according to Jewish scripture. So, you know, whether it's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, obviously no one knows, but I don't think that there's anyone who really understands this issue that would debate or negate the opinion that we are right there. Right. We are right there. Again, I don't know if it's a day or a year or a decade. I don't know. But in the grand scheme of history, we are right there. And I'm going to say something maybe a little slightly off topic, but I have to say it because if we're talking about Mashiach, this is a big part of Mashiach. One of the characteristics of the days of Mashiach is what we call Kibbutz Galiot, which is all the Jews coming home to Israel from around the world. Right. And, you know, there's a very comprehensive, like real, you know, deep debate amongst Jewish scholars whether the Mashiach and the times of Mashiach will be supernatural or will be completely natural, but the world will know that Hashem is one, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the Maimonides, the Rambam, says it's going to be more natural. We're not going to have animal sacrifices, and the temple's not going to land from the sky. It's going to be more natural and whatever. And so, you know, going according to that and according to, let's call it the Jewish philosophy of, you know, the modern Orthodox, as opposed to the ultra Orthodox, which are some people that are often not necessarily pro the state of Israel because they think we have to wait till Mashiach comes before, et cetera, et cetera. If we believe that it's in our hands, and that's why we are back in Israel, even though Mashiach hasn't come, presumably we believe that it's in our hands. And so if it's in our hands, you know, I'm reminded of the story of the famous story that everyone I'm sure knows, which is, you know, there's a flood and the man gets on the roof and, you know, it's the water starts going higher and he says, I'm going to stay here. And they send a boat and get on the boat. He says, no, Hashem, God will save me. And he stays on the roof. And then God, you know, then a helicopter comes and get on the helicopter. He says, no, God will save me. And then he drowns and he goes up to God. He says, I don't understand. I believed in you. Why didn't you save me? And he says, I didn't say, what do you mean? Why didn't I save you? I sent a boat. I sent the helicopter. You didn't get on it. And I'm very much reminded of that because I'm thinking if we believe that all of the Jews from around the world are going to gather into the land of Israel. Well, if we go up to God one day and say, God, why didn't you bring us back home? I think he's going to say to us, what do you mean I didn't bring you back home? I gave you elal.com. I gave you nefesh benefesh. I gave you the tools. I sent the boat. Why didn't you get on the boat? And so, you know, if the answer is, oh, God has to do it. God has to bring Mashiach and it's all supernatural. Then I don't think that is aligned with our philosophy that we do have to make our effort. We do have to, you know, fight for the land of Israel, even though it's not yet Mashiach and we're not in the ultimate, you know, pure sacred land of Israel, even though it's, you know, a secular state, it's still part of the process of bringing Mashiach. So if we believe that, then why are we not taking more action to bring Mashiach? Why are we not building the temple? I mean, what, literally, we know where it was. Of course, that's highly, you know, controversial because, you know, El Aqsa, and it's we're not going to go there, but if we believe as Jews that it's in our hands to bring Mashiach, why are we not bringing him? Why are we not in gathering? Why are we not all coming home? Why are we, you know, staying outside of Israel where we're not even welcome anymore? You know, maybe 50 years ago, you could say, okay, you know, America, it's the land of, you know, dreams. But that's no longer the case for Jews today. And so when I say to my friends around the world, what are you waiting for? You know, I say to them, is there anything that can happen that you'll realize that you're no longer America or wherever you are around the world is no longer your home? I mean, what hasn't happened? If I told you that, you know, 10 years ago, if I told you that one day there are going to be anti-Semites in Congress and Jews are going to be beaten in the streets and academic institutions are going to prevent Jews from walking freely on campus and synagogues are going to be vandalized, you would have said to me, you being any rational person would have said to me, if that happens, I'm not sticking around, I'm out of there. And here we are. So I say to my friends, like, what are you waiting for? And I got to tell you, on a personal level, I've struggled with that question my whole life. Why didn't my grandmother get out? What was she thinking when there was, you know, when it was just rhetoric and Hitler was just saying what he was saying? It was just words. Okay. But when there was Nuremberg laws and they were legislating against Jews, what did she think was going to happen? So the answer is I didn't know that answer. I didn't know the answer to that question my whole life. And now I do. And now I do because it's all happened. And my friends are all experiencing it and they're sticking around. And I'm like, guys, come home. Yes, we're not perfect here. Yes, there's a war. I'm not dismissing any of that. But here, this is the fundamental difference that so many people don't understand. Here, there is an IDF that has a mission to protect you. Now, the IDF failed at that mission on October 7th, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that, but that doesn't mean there's no mission. There still is an army here dedicated to protecting me. Who's protecting you? Not you. Who's protecting Jews? We know that no one's protecting them anymore. So, you know, yes, it's not perfect here. Yes, there are challenges. Yes, Israelis drive like crazy people. Yes, but this is home. And to quote my friend, again, Rabbi Goldberg, he said something else which so strongly resonated with me. He said, we're on a business trip. Us Jews, we're on a business trip. Like when you're on a business trip, you know, you stay in nice hotels, you maybe get yourself a nice car, but you're on a business trip. Don't forget that. You're not home. And so, yes, you're living in America right now, and you have your fancy cars, and you have your great lifestyle, but you're on a business trip. Don't forget where's home. And unfortunately, too many people have forgotten, and it's time we woke up and realized we have to take matters into our own hands. We need to come home. Because that's our job. That's what God's telling us to do. That's what God has always told us to do. We need to come home, period.
Amen from Los Angeles. And let me just say, I take zero offense to that. Making Aliyah is something that I think about constantly. I mean, if I just wanted to get into some of the practical, you know, considerations, you know, it's just really quickly, you know, the fact that the cost of living in Israel is significantly more than even living in Brentwood in Los Angeles, you know, makes it difficult. But anyway, I'm not going to defend myself, but we could do that offline.
But I have to go on record. I have to go on record because we're not going to get into this topic, but I have to go on record to push back and say that's not an 100% accurate statement. Again, it's a complex issue, but it's no longer a black and white situation where one can state, you know, unequivocally that you A, make less money in Israel, B, life is more expensive in Israel. There are sacrifices to be made. I'm not dismissing that, but Israel is not what it used to be. That's all I'm saying.
Believe me, I'm there all the time. I've been there twice this year. I gotta drop this because now I'm just getting self-defensive, but I know that my huge condo in Brentwood would be traded in for a postage stamp in Tel Aviv. And I do know for a fact what the going rate for a yoga instructor is in Tel Aviv compared to Los Angeles, and it's approximately one quarter.
Why is Tel Aviv the measuring stick? Tel Aviv is the most expensive city in the world.
I know, because I love Tel Aviv. It's the most vibrant city on earth.
You know that there's a city called, just to give an example, there's a city called Petah Tikva, okay? Petah Tikva is a 15-minute ride from Tel Aviv. People have to understand, this country is, so when you talk about another city that's not Tel Aviv, we're talking about like walking distance, and you can buy a house in any of those cities besides Tel Aviv and Herzliya for a fraction of that. So again, yes, if you're going to compare Tel Aviv, then there's no discussion, but there are other places that one can live that are super close to Tel Aviv that will cost a fraction of that.
Okay, we're going to talk offline. Maybe, you know what they say, next year in Jerusalem. Believe me that it pains me that I'm not there. And when I leave, and particularly since Ben Gurion, since they put up all the hostage posters on the, I don't know what you call it, the ramp in and out, I feel like I'm abandoning my people. Believe me, I feel it on such a visceral level. But
my offer is when you come to Israel, shawarma's on me.
Well, I'm a vegan, so we're gonna have to find a vegan
shawarma. Vegan shawarma. By the way, that's a big thing in Israel. You know that veganism's like every restaurant now has vegan burgers. It's a big thing in Israel.
100%. Israel has the highest percentage of vegans of any country in the world. And again, that speaks to the morality of a nation that, you know, people really choose like their life, even secular Jews, like they are guided by principles.
As a carnivore, I'm biting my lips right now. I'm biting my tongue not to answer, but I hear what you're saying. I understand your perspective. Okay. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay, so your thing about Israel, my thing about we'll dig out the merits of the arguments. Okay, hardest question that I can ask. And we've touched upon it. We just touched upon it before we went on this tangent about me defending living in Los Angeles. I hate to say it, but there's no denying it, that times like this certainly test a person's faith in God. Not everyone, but many. Can you give your personal advice? And you already, again, tangentially touched upon this, but more specifically for maintain, not just like, thank you, God, like Modani, thank God, my feet touch the floor, right. I have another day. Because if you lose faith in the world, having another day isn't such a great thing sometimes. So right. What is your personal advice for maintaining faith, even in the face of such grave tragedy and horror?
I mean, you know, I don't know if there's a right answer because faith is such a personal thing, but I'm going to push back on the premise. I actually don't think that statistically is true. I think if you look around the world, there are so many Jews, again, anecdotally, I see it on my social media, who have actually come closer to God as a result of this war, because it brings us back to what we said before, which is that unfortunately, in every generation, our enemies remind us who we are, right? And so many Jews around the world are coming closer to God right now, and which is, of course, an interesting thing. But to just kind of answer your question, you know, what would I say to someone who, you know, maybe questions God in this time? Again, it's a super personal thing. If someone, God forbid, loses a loved one, or you know, let's go even more extreme. Someone went through Auschwitz and abandoned their faith. Half the people went through Auschwitz, abandoned. Half the people became, you know, I could never judge someone who went through that and lost faith in God. I could never judge that person. I could answer, you know, from a theological, philosophical, personal level that I, you know, which we talked about before, which is that God is clearly running the show because there's no other logical explanation. But I can't come to someone and say, yeah, you know, October 7th happened and all these people are dying, but you got to believe in God, because you can't, you know, it's such a personal, emotional thing that, you know, I could talk logic till I'm blue in the face, but we know that by definition, faith is not logic, because if it's logic, then it's no longer faith, right? So that's a long way to say I don't have an answer to your question. I don't know how to answer someone who says things are so dark, how could you believe in God? I'll say, I hear what you're saying. It's a personal thing.
Yeah, the challenge is the concept of omnipotence. Because either you're omnipotent or you're not. You can't be omnipotent and not omnipotent. However, you can give people free will. And in your omnipotence, you can choose to give people free will. And we see what people do with that will. We see it very starkly in front of us. Do you have a, we've been talking for so long. Do you have a, do you want to, can we continue talking about Jewish things, or do you want to wrap this up?
So I'm getting like my text messages are coming in from my family. Okay. Yeah, I'm standards. I'm going to give my kids dinner and stuff. So I unfortunately have to end this, but this was fun. I had a great time. We could do this again.
Oh, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. So let us just, I always like to just finish on a note of hope. Where do you see Hatikva? Where do you ultimately see the hope in Israel, in the world today, in all the things?
I go back to the root. I go back to the Torah. I go back to history, and we know that history repeats itself. So if we know that history repeats itself, if you want to know what's going to happen, open a history book, right? And we know what's going to happen. I'll give you the script right now. And by the way, to be clear, I'm not a prophet, but I am a person who has his eyes open. And 2 days before October 7th, and this is very, you can go to my social media, verify this if you want. I wrote a post October 5th and said, if you're paying attention to the situation in the world today between Russia and Ukraine, America and Iran, America and China, internal politics, and you don't think something big is about to happen, then you're not paying attention. And I wrote in the post, Israel will be at the center of it. Now, how did I know that? I'm not, again, not because I'm a prophet, because I've had my eyes are open. And so as a person who has his eyes open, I could tell you what's about to happen. Here's the script. There is an empire. Again, ancient Egypt, Roman, all of them. There's an empire. And that empire grows and grows and grows until it reaches unparalleled power and influence in the world. And the first thing that that empire does when it reaches that level of power and influence is it throws morality out the window. It puts people to fight to the death in the Colosseum, right? It gets rid of morality. And then when morality is out the window, that empire says, I don't want morality shoved down my throat. So I'm going to go after the source of that morality, except that I can't kill the creator of morality, God. So I come after the messenger, right? You kill FedEx, you don't get your package. And we are the messengers, right? We brought the Torah to the world. And before the Torah, it wasn't immoral to murder. Because in ancient times, murder was part of life until the Torah said it's immoral to murder. And that's what the world understands today. So we brought morality historically, not in a supremacist kind of way. Historically, we brought morality to the world. And so when the world decides they don't want morality, they come after us. And in every generation, we think, pardon me, like idiots, that we can come and say to them, don't hate us, we're just like you. And then they say, no, you're not. And then anti-Semitism spikes. And when anti-Semitism spikes, the empire falls. So unless the trajectory in Western civilization goes 180 and the genie goes back in the bottle and anti-Semitism goes back, which it will never do because that's not what happens, then I am scared and sad and devastated to say that America, which has been so good to my family, and Western civilization, which is, you know, values that I believe to the core of my being, sadly, unfortunately, history seems to dictate that Western civilization is reaching its end. And we know what takes over Western civilization because it's as clear as day. Radical Islam has set their goal of taking over Western civilization, and it's working. Let's not kid ourselves. They're penetrating, you know, the academic world. They're penetrating militarily. They're penetrating politically. They're penetrating all aspects of Western civilization, and we're not far off from them, unfortunately, accomplishing their goal and taking over. And you know, I wish nothing more than to be wrong, but history seems to predict that I'm not.
Okay, so I'm going to say the hope is in the continuation.
Sorry, I know that was supposed to be optimistic. I'm sorry.
No, Israel is a beacon of light of Western civilization. And thank you. So
we're here with our arms open. Anyone's welcome here. That's the most important thing.
Yes, everyone's welcome here. Hillel, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and even eating into your dinner. I'm going to let you go because that's the kind of person I am. And from the deepest depths of my heart, I'm Yisrael Chai. Yisrael Chai.